a $300,000 paper mill. All hopes for that had been dashed. And the reason why it had fallen through, as I mentioned last time, I believe is because adequate measures had not indeed been taken to prepare steps necessary to build a dam. Let's take a good look at this. To visitor and resident alike, the numerous lakes and streams and lush green forest of northern Minnesota might indicate little need for concern about water or water supply. To turn-of-the-century Grand Rapids businessmen serious about developing the water power of the rapids, the matter seems simple. Find financial backing, build a dam, and harness the power. After all, the population of the region was thinly scattered over a wide area. The location was remote, and the businessmen believed the Mississippi there belonged to those who had invested their time and energies in Grand Rapids. In any event, navigation ended at the place where a dam would be built, and such construction would not interfere with the existing uses of the river. Such reasoning was spacious. Yeah, you can't just go and dam the Mississippi River. Some other things are very much needed. Some background on this. Actually, the waters of northern Minnesota were of great interest to many. Waterways, once important to the Indians, the French, and the British fur traders, had come under the control of the United States Army Corps of Engineers. The primary function of the Corps, which operated under the ultimate authority of the Secretary of War, was to maintain, improve, and protect navigation routes. The involvement of the Corps in the Mississippi Headwaters region occurred in a roundabout manner. The Corps showed little interest in proposals made in 1850 to construct a reservoir system on the upper Mississippi to control water levels much further to the south. The Corps deemed such construction too expensive to be practical, and anyway, more geared to commercial water power interests than navigation, and nothing was done. William D. Washburn, a United States representative and later senator from Minnesota, Washburn became involved in the issue in the 1870s. Having important financial connections with milling and water power development at the Falls of St. Anthony, he was very much aware that the flow of the river there was irregular, sometimes dwindling to an alarming low point and leaving commercial establishments without sufficient power. While he had good reason of his own to want a controlled flow of the Mississippi, he forcefully argued for regulating the water to keep the channel below St. Paul open for continued operation of steamboats. To that end, he very articulately called for a congressional appropriation for the Corps of Engineers to begin work on a northern Minnesota reservoir. In other words, he's being pretty sneaky here. The Corps of Engineers is interested in navigation, so he says that's what it's for. But in reality, what he wants and what the other owners of the various places reliant on water power in Minneapolis want is, of course, adequate water to keep the machinery moving. But Washburn won endorsement for his plan from many southern Mississippi River towns whose economic status did depend on steamboat passage. In 1879, when Grand Rapids was still no more than a nucleus of log buildings, the River Improvement Association held its convention in Quincy, Illinois. Probably there wasn't a single person in Grand Rapids who knew of the convention's enthusiastic approval of plans to build dams in northern Minnesota, and one was to be at the head of the rapids, just a few miles from Grand Rapids. The railroad companies, objecting to the use of federal monies for improving river commerce, strongly opposed the reservoir plans. Ironically, resistance also came from St. Paul commercial interests, who saw that Washburn's real purpose was to protect water power and rifle Minneapolis. But despite opposition, in 1880, Congress appropriated funds to build dams in northern Minnesota. In succeeding years, further monies were allocated. By 1884, the Corps had constructed dams at Lake Winnebogoches, at Leech Lake, and at Pokegama Falls, a few miles west of Grand Rapids. The new reservoir system increased the flow of water at the Falls of St. Anthony dramatically, substantially aiding Minneapolis water power users. In August and September, the volume of water was 40% higher than in past years, and in October and November, it had increased by another 10%. The question of whether the dams actually aided steamboat navigation remained hotly debated. So, the Mississippi River at Grand Rapids is associated with issues and perspectives far broader than just those of Dan Gunn and the citizens interested in the economic well-being of their town. Gunn and the others came to realize that the erection of a paper mill dependent on the construction of a sizable dam would require careful and systematic preparation. Another committee was created, according to the minutes of the village council, because of a mass meeting of tax-paying citizens. Dan Gunn was, of course, again an active participant, and he was charged, once again, with making an effort to secure the location of a paper mill in the village. In September of 1898, Gunn and other members of the committee met with the council to request money to employ competent persons to ascertain the amount of flowage which would be caused by the construction of a dam across the river within the city limits. The council approved the expenditure, and this time the necessary homework was underway. Early in January of 1899, a major step was taken with the formation of a corporation called the Grand Rapids Water Power and Boom Company. The articles of incorporation stated the purpose of the organization as the construction and maintenance of dams, canals, mills, and booms across and along the Mississippi River and its tributaries, and such businesses may be incidental thereto. The Herald Review explained that if the city of Grand Rapids developed the water power of the Mississippi, the power could be used only for municipal purposes and not for private industry. To avoid that restriction, the city decided to register the new corporation and pay the fees that were required on its behalf. And in return, the private investors would eventually transfer majority control of the company to the people of Grand Rapids as represented by their village council. So pretty tricky stuff here. They're as good at doing this as Washburn was down in the cities. For the plan to succeed, the community had to place trust in the incorporators of the Water Power and Boom Company. In other words, it now will be theirs, and they just simply will have to be trusted that they're going to turn it over to the council when the time came. But the Herald Review referred to those citizens, including, of course, Dan Gunn and other prominent Grand Rapids businessmen, as patriotic and loyal to the interests of Grand Rapids. Elected the president of the company, Dan Gunn immediately began to carry out the first and most important purpose of the new corporation. He asked U.S. Representative Page Morris to prepare an act seeking permission for the Grand Rapids Water Power and Boom Company to construct the dam across the Mississippi. Morris acted quickly, got approval of the Army Corps of Engineers, and submitted it to Congress. He saw difficulty in gaining passage of the bill before Congress adjourned. To assure the federal body that the dam was in the public interest and not just for the convenience of private industry, the council passed a resolution stating, whereas it is of very great importance to the residents of Grand Rapids and vicinity that the bill shall become law during the present session of Congress, be it resolved that we, the Council of the Village of Grand Rapids, Minnesota, do most earnestly petition our representative in Congress and our U.S. senators to use their best efforts to pass the bill during the present session of Congress. Armed with that resolution, Dan Gunn went to Washington to give all possible aid to Morris and to Minnesota's senators. The War Department approved the plans, and on February 27th of 1899, a special act of Congress granted a charter to the Grand Rapids Water Power and Boom Company, allowing the erection of the dam. The first major hurdle had been crossed, but much remained to be done. Plans for the new dam had to be developed, and the acreage to be inundated had to be assessed. The Grand Rapids Water Power and Boom Company had powers of eminent domain, enabling the acquisition of property, and the legal documents requesting condemnation of property to be flooded was in itself 42 oversized pages. Court-appointed commissioners had to assess each parcel of the affected property, and even as that work progressed, the council appointed a committee to visit and learn about paper mill districts in Wisconsin, hoping to generate interest in developing the Grand Rapids site. And needless to say, it was Dan Gunn who headed that committee making that visit. Despite the remarkable progress in January and February, the rest of 1899 slipped by with no dam under construction because the Congressional Act had allowed only a year to begin work on the projected dam. A second bill was necessary. In February of 1900, Congress granted a four-year extension. So lots of detail, lots of work, lots of stuff to do. Lots of effort, certainly, on the part of Dan Gunn. Are we getting closer to finding a paper mill? We'll continue next time.